The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
From the Transmission of the Light, Case 22, Vasubandhu. Master Jayata said, "I do not seek the way, yet I am not confused. I do not pay obeisance to Buddha, yet I do not disregard Buddha either. I do not sit for long periods, yet I am not lazy. I do not limit my meals, yet I do not eat indiscriminately either. I am not contented, yet I am not greedy. When the mind does not seek anything, this is called the way." When Vasubandhu heard this, he discovered uncontaminated knowledge. Kazan's verse. The wind traverses the vast sky. Clouds emerge from the mountains. Feelings of enlightenment and things of the world are of no concern at all. So here we are in our waning hours of this session and of this ongo. It's hard to believe it was 3 months, or maybe not. We began and the mountain was filled with life and covered with a green carpet and the air was warm, and now we're in the midst of change. Amidst a sea of cause and effect, we are practicing to free ourselves. Perhaps the most essentially human impulse. The Buddha recognized that our greediness, our anger, our delusion, our pride, our jealousy, our fear, all of these mental factors, all of these states of mind that arise ultimately out of a sense that somehow we have become distanced from something essential. And to make up for that distance, we create something unknowingly, in a way, innocently, as a function of our consciousness, a sense of a substantial, permanent self. And then we impart that same sense to everything around us. And so he said, if we practice the middle path of not denying, and not grasping, of not seeking an utter non-existence, but not seeking anything eternal. By avoiding those extremes, we will encounter a true way. And so we cultivate these wonderful, beautiful qualities, simple qualities, present in every human being, patience and generosity, tolerance, forbearing, perseverance, faith, respect, reverence, devotion. I was listening to a talk recently by Thay Sithu, and he was talking about devotion, and he said when we reflect on the life of the Buddha, this enlightened being, or we see a realized being who's living that realization, and it inspires us, that our desire to realize that within ourselves is devotion. That when we see others who are caught in samsara, as we ourselves are, have been, and we want deeply to do whatever we can to help others, that's also devotion. As I mentioned earlier, these accounts of these masters, here Vasubandhu is thought to have lived in the end of the first century of the Common Era. So this is very, very early, and the records are very scant. And it's impossible to know how much of this is based in history and how much of it has been fleshed out, which, as usual, is not really our primary concern. But the story is that Jayata was traveling, and came to the area where Vasubandhu was living. And Vasubandhu was part of a school, a community that was basically philosophically based, and Vasubandhu was sort of their chief person, their elder. And he was very disciplined, very sort of a good example, a perfect example of within their community. He limited his meals to once a day. He never laid down to sleep. He performed ritual obeisances to an image of the Buddha repeatedly throughout the day. He was pure and desireless, was considered an ideal practitioner. And when Jayata came and mingled with this group, he said, "This ascetic Vasubandhu practices pure conduct well, but can he attain the Buddha way?" And the group got a little upset about this, and they said, "Our teacher is very diligent. How could there be anything wrong?" And Jayata said, "Your teacher is far from the way. Even if someone practices asceticism for eons, ultimately this is the root of illusion." And the group said, "Well, what virtue do you have that you can criticize our teacher this way?" And Jayata said, "I do not seek enlightenment, but I'm not confused. I do not pay obeisance to Buddha, but I don't disregard Buddha either," and so on. "When the mind does not seek anything, this is called the way." And it said that at those words, Jayata realized enlightenment. And Jayata went on to explain to the group and said, "Do you understand my words, why I'm saying this?" And he said, "My reason for saying what I did is that Vasubandhu's search for enlightenment was too eager. If the harp string is too tight, it'll snap. Therefore, I didn't praise him, but made him abide in the state of peace so that he could enter the knowledge of all Buddhas." Practicing the middle way might sound kind of easy. You know, just stay in the middle. Stay in the middle of the road. When you start to wander, just come back to the middle of the road. Keep things in balance. And those can be good things, but the middle way is much more dynamic, profound, ungraspable. And so within this path, within this sangha in which we are enlightening beings, practicing the enlightened path, to realize ourselves and to do whatever we can in our lives to serve others, we're doing that while deluded, driving while under the influence. Right? And so while we're practicing freeing ourselves of anger, we get angry. While we practice giving generously, we are stingy. While we practice our vows to be compassionate to each other, we hurt each other. And so a sangha is a vibrant, living embodiment of how do we do that? Because that's sort of the deal. We have to be in this path while under the influence of our mind and others' minds. And then the consequences of that will come out. While we are practicing to gather those in, to shift the tide, to live our vows, it's a very sort of amazing thing. In a way, it's very simple, very natural. How else could it be? But when we really think about it, and then how do we do that? Like, how have we done that for 40 years? 41 years. How in our commitment to bringing the Bodhisattva truth into this world, into our particular world, into our bodies, into our sangha, within our Beyond Fear of Differences work, within our undoing racism, healing the immeasurable, uncountable legacy of the enslavement of Africans and Black people in this country. How do we unbind ourselves, right? Particularly those of us who are white, who have been conditioned to not be aware, not see, not know? How do we unbind ourselves without hurting each other, particularly without hurting, as white folks, hurting people who are black, people of color, Asian? We will hurt each other. And so even without our intention to do so. And of course, if that isn't there, then we are in more serious trouble. That intention is, in a sense, that is what holds us together. It isn't the high salaries. It isn't the promises of, you know, whatever. It's our mutual trust. That's the glue. That's what makes this possible. And so we aspire, we establish our intentions, we take vows, we commit to those vows, we renew those vows, we return to those vows. And if we haven't taken vows, then we are being exposed to all of that, introduced to all of that. What is all of that? And we begin to encounter, in a sense, to experiment with this idea of living a life of vow. And trying to wade through and get to the reality of that. It's not about living a perfect life. It's about living this life while being a perfect being, a Buddha. And living that Buddha life imperfectly. And that's our universal place of meeting. And so we move forward, we slip back, we renew, we strengthen, we forget. You know, I was thinking of the history, our history. You know, Ibram Kendi eloquently writes about how, you know, racism wasn't the cause of slavery over 400 years ago, but it was power. Power from on the part of land barons who had wealth and wanted more wealth and wanted it as cheaply as possible. And so that greed, that power led to, in a sense, required the racist ideologies and religious, scientific, economic, judicial backing to justify it. How do you make something that is morally untenable, morally unjustifiable, justifiable? And the power of our minds to do that, to turn what is upside down, right side up, is a good bit of the history of human beings. And I thought, in a way, that's the quintessential American, it's not about the meatloaf, right? It's not about Africans. It's not about African Americans. It's not about blackness. It's not about race. It's about power. It's about money. It's about wanting. It's about desire. And of course, in that, I mean, how could anyone subjugate another person, another people, without already having a sense of superiority? And so our commitment to undiluting ourselves all the way through, and that's, you know, Buddhism is a very intent teaching. Right? You don't encounter teachings that are like, you know, for the faint of heart, you know, for those who aspire to a mediocre, you don't see those teachings. They speak to who we are. And they invite, they challenge, sometimes demand that we live that. Because the cost of not doing that is dire. And so these qualities of accountability in the 10 values, that we cultivate trust, that we hold each other accountable. And the only way that works, as it says in the 10 values, is that if we are confident, if somebody holds me accountable, and it's clear to me that they care about me on some level, they might be angry. But in holding me accountable, they're not trying to hurt me. They're not trying to kill me. They're trying to point something out, in a sense, to bring us closer. And if in that moment they have the sense that I'm trying to do the same thing, That's a very powerful bond that can withstand our transgressions, that can withstand our faults, the missteps, the misspeaking, the misactions that we will and do commit. PSA, for the white identified members of Sangha, we're doing a workshop on trans microaggressions coming up with Mary Ellen and Eduardo, speaking directly to this. How do we live with each other while deluded and undiluting ourselves with a conscientious effort to minimize the harm that we do to each other? We can't eliminate it, but we can do everything we can to minimize it. And then when we create that harm, what we do then becomes really, really important, is really important, because that's where we have the chance to restore trust, to restore that sense of bond that we have with each other, that we have confidence that we are mutually concerned for each other and that we are dedicated to that. And so having courage, being able to be vulnerable, to tolerate discomfort of our own delusion, to have humility. I don't know what more than Dharma practice could help to cultivate humility. Reverence, generosity, authenticity, and all of these qualities that I think of coming back to this bond that we have with each other, that we are counting on each other, we can trust each other, that we are in this together, and we're trying to do this together, and we actually need each other. You and I have had many conversations over the years. I remember when Dada Roshi, when I was finishing my training, and said, "Now your teacher is the Sangha." And I thought, yeah, I get that. I had no idea. I had an idea, but it was a very, very small idea. And I think of how much I've learned and how indebted I am to that, how much that has helped me. And yet, in those conversations you and I have had, it was really important for me to always know that it was never Chike's responsibility or any of the others of you, many of you I've had other conversations with, to educate me, to call me out, to inform me, to do what I need to be doing, that's my responsibility. So that when I do get some help, that is wonderful. But I don't wait for it. In the commentary, Kazan says, if you think there is Buddhahood to attain and a way to find, and so you fast or do ascetic exercises with that thought, or you sit for long periods of time without lying down, do prostrations, recite scriptures, build up merits for attaining the way, all of this is raining flowers in a flowerless sky, making holes where there are no holes. Not craving anything is called the way. So even if it is contentment that you want, this is still ultimately based in greed. And, you know, even though the Buddha rejected ascetic practice after having been sort of the most ascetic of the ascetics, he said, his words, whatever Brahmins or contemplatives in the past, present, or future have felt, are feeling, or will feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to their striving, this that I have experienced, this that I have subjected myself to is the utmost. None have been greater than this. But with this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any sublime human state, any distinction in knowledge or vision worthy of a noble one. Could there be another path? Could there be another path? And then he remembers, I thought, he says, I recall once when my father was working and I was sitting in the shade of a rose apple tree and quite secluded from stimulation, sensuality, he says, unskillful mental qualities, I entered and remained in the first jhana, the first level of meditation that was an essential part of his teaching. Could that be the path? How extraordinary. right? That after having traveled so far from home, having engaged in all of these different practices, bringing himself to the literal edge of death, threshold of death, he remembered back to a moment of innocence, of not seeking the way. And perhaps because of his brilliance, his sort of inherent spiritual brightness, he fell into that deep state of meditation, and then only after all of this, he remembers. Maybe he had to go through all that to be able to have exhausted all of those possibilities and then could trust such a moment of simplicity, of not striving after having consumed himself with striving for all of those years. And so because of that, we do not have to go that way. Shantideva says, because I use this body to practice bodhicitta, I should not harm it for the sake of temporary benefits, but rather care for it so that I may fulfill my bodhicitta wish, so that eventually all living beings' wishes will be fulfilled. In other words, I should take care of this body because it is my vehicle by which I can fulfill my vows. But, of course, this doesn't mean that we can just casually, half-heartedly follow the path. Just have no attachments. What has been transmitted down through the ages is this. This. If you read Dogen's teachings in his Aishinge, this is what he describes. Of course, cultural, it's different, it's the 13th century. But the essence, the basic practices are the same. As I said on Monday night, the breaking down of the day into four sessions, that's not just Zen, that's throughout Buddhism. Before dawn, mid-morning, afternoon, evening. A way of structuring the day, practicing the day. And obviously there's a rigor. So it's not just that what's been transmitted is the form, the schedule, it's a wholehearted effort. It's practicing as though your head's on fire. It's the evening gatha. It's the continual reminder of impermanence and the fleeting nature of this life. The continual reminder that you have Buddha nature. And so in establishing the three treasures, in establishing a place of Dharma practice, as Dadarushi did in 1980, this field of benefaction. The challenge is that we understand that in establishing this, we are not establishing anything that exists inherently, in and of itself. It's all clouds and water. It's all space and mist. It's all subject to impermanence. It is all for our benefit. I think it's in the in one of the videos in which Dadarushi is speaking, he talks about having, you know, really committed his life here to establishing, putting down roots, setting this up, and then bringing forth the Eightfold Path, the Eight Gates of Zen, bringing forth the Mountains and Rivers Order, all of the training that we're still practicing. And in that, he said, you know, there may be at some point somebody down the line, some teacher down the line decides, you know, the Eight Gates really isn't working anymore. You know, we need to do something else. And he said, it needs to have that kind of flexibility. I don't have anything in mind. I'm not setting you up for anything. But that having devoted so much of his energy, spiritual, creative, physical energy to establishing that, he said, yeah, as long as it works, use it. If it's not working anymore, then let it go. Kezan said, the disciples of the Buddha, and that's us, set up various kinds of pure regulations to show the disciplined behavior of Buddhas and ancestors. Clinging to them obsessively becomes an affliction, however, a passion, an obstruction. Furthermore, if you must reject birth and death to seek the way, then yet you cannot cut off the beginningless process of dying in one place and being born in another, what state would you consider attainment of the way? Yet you want to seek the way while still caught up in all of these things. It's all a misunderstanding. And so we practice. We can't intellectually free ourselves of this. We have to embody it, which means we have to actually get caught. And it doesn't mean we have to go out of our way to get caught. Just wake up, start your day, it'll happen. Care about something deeply, it will happen. Commit yourself to something, it will happen. So reflecting on this, how do you understand bodhicitta, this great aspiration? Why do we meditate on the fleeting nature of life and death, the instability of samsara? Why have teachers throughout the ages offered endless words of encouragement, guidance, and faith to motivate us in our seeking, to motivate us in our aspiration? And in that, as we go about that, the way we have gone about the things in our life, we will cling to things. We will attach. We will create solid objects out of clouds and mist. And so we practice seeking without clinging, committing without expectations, being devoted without turning away from oneself. We actually embody it, we experience it, we free ourselves on the spot again and again and again. I do not seek the way, but I am not confused. I do not pay obeisance to Buddha, but I don't disregard Buddha either. I don't sit for long periods, but I'm not lazy. I don't limit my meals, but I don't eat indiscriminately. I'm not contented, yet I'm not greedy. When the mind does not seek anything, this is called the way. To practice without identifying with practice, with oneself as a practitioner, as a Buddhist, as a Buddha. Well, then why do we do these things? In a sense, it's a continual practice of not defiling the three treasures. Though there be wise ones and fools in the way, there is no high and low, no superior and inferior. And we are different. Thank goodness we are different. I remember talking to somebody years ago who was actually on the monastic path. They left and went on in a different way. But I remember at one point them saying that if they could ever find somebody just like them, they would marry them on the spot. And I thought, well, that's honest. Wonder how that would work out, actually. Be careful what you wish for. But I thought that was just sort of a vivid expression of like self-clinging. And we don't practice not clinging because it's morally right. Because it's the right thing to do, because it's the good thing, it's what Buddhists do. It's because that brings us into tune, into alignment with everything. When we attach, in that very moment, we are in conflict. We are at odds. We are in trouble. Kazan said, even all this being so, beginners should carefully study to actually arrive at this stage of equanimity and peace. No conflict. No boundaries in the mind. For if you yourself have no genuine understanding, you may be deluded by the words of others. So if you try to lift your eyes to see, you'll be invaded by the Buddha demon. That is, if we look outside of ourselves. Today, even though you hear such talk and understand that there's nothing to attain, but if a teacher tells you there's some doctrine to realize, or if a Buddha demon comes and tells you there's some method to practice, ultimately your mind will be stirred and you'll go astray. accepting the true teaching of all Buddhas, investigate them carefully and thoroughly. That's the difference. Faith is having faith in those teachings. What keeps it from being a blind faith is exactly that. Investigate it carefully and thoroughly so that you yourself reach the realm where you are at peace. You verify the truth of those teachings. Someone who has attained this peace is like someone who has had enough to eat. Even a great feast would no longer really appeal to them. This is why it's said that fine food is not for the satisfied to eat. An ancient one said, once troubled, finally now at rest. And so when it is helpful and beneficial to establish something, to set something up, to do that when it's necessary for the sake of study, for the sake of practice, for the sake of skillful means, for the sake of liberation. And so we have a chief disciple. Yeah, a living being. And it's a training position. Right? Everything here is a training position, including being a teacher. We have senior students, we have Jikai students, we have people who are not students. We have monastics. We have all of these different ways of being here together. And all for the express purpose of seeing into the real nature of things. Why did Fayan one day, before he gave the talk, point over to the blinds? Two students went over and raised them up alike. And Fayan said, one has it and one has not. Why did he do that? Why did Zhao Zhou, visiting two hermits, saying, are you in? They both raised their fist alike. And to one, Zhao Zhou said, it's too shallow here to anchor a vessel. And to the other, he said, you have the power to kill and to give life. They raised their fist alike. Why did he say that? For our benefit. For their benefit. There's nothing theoretical about this. We cannot liberate ourselves from suffering while suffering is hidden behind a veil. We free ourselves in the midst of it. That is the fire, the lotus in the fire. And living together, being deluded together, aspiring together, freeing ourselves together, injuring each other, repairing our injuries, is how we discover our capacity, how we discover our true nature, how we discover how to live in this world, in this body, with these bodies. And so we practice to get to the heart of it so that we can begin to enter into that profound complexity of your mind, of my mind, of our shared world. We practice just sitting, just walking, just bowing, just resting. There is no need for a description, for a narrator, for labeling, for assessing, for judging, for comparing. There is no need for someone to be doing it. I do not seek the way, but I'm not confused. I don't pay obeisance to Buddha, but I don't disregard Buddha either. There has never been a self in charge of it all. Once troubled, finally at rest. Once troubled, realizing always, there was always someone who was at rest. Otherwise, we would be creating a state of rest. We would be creating an experience of stillness, creating an experience of silence. That's not what we're doing. That's not ever been done. Whatever degree that has been done, that something resembling that has been created, it's not actually rest. It's not silence, not stillness, because those cannot be created. And so we are on a path of not creating, not identifying. Kezan says, you have thought mistaken what has never been mistaken. Do not waste time concerning yourself with the frost on another person's yard while forgetting about the treasure in your own house. I thought that was so wonderful. What a very particular thing to be concerned about. And I think you can just insert any particular getting in somebody else's business effort you want there while forgetting about the treasure in our own house. In other words, how deeply we can get involved in things that have never happened, will never happen. Adjudicating disagreements that don't actually exist, that we will never be asked to speak on. Just realize we have thought mistaken what has never been mistaken. What a wonderful, simple way of saying something so essential. And so from the beginning, if this is true, then why do we create so much pain and sorrow? Why? Well, thorough examination reveals much in response to that. But you know what? We can understand karma and still be caught in it. Understanding it is not enough. Being aware of it is not enough. We have to actually unbind, embodied, moment to moment. And in that, we are being welcomed into the family of humankind. It's not a criticism, it's not praise, it's just an honest recognition of what every person sees when they turn the light around. And so because of that, we need to seek the way. We need to bow to the Buddha, to sit for long periods, to practice Oryoki, to know how to be satisfied, to have few desires. We need to raise bodhicitta. We need to discover that within ourselves, to examine the power of our mind, of establishing an intention, of having faith, of quieting and working with our doubts and insecurities, of learning how to close the gap. All of this is essential. And to do it with urgency. Because we are freeing ourselves while deluded. I remember years ago, there was a student here who came to me at a certain point. He was here for several years and said, please don't give me any position where I will have influence on another person. And I said, even if I was God, I could not do that. There is not such a thing. And so this, I was going to say merciless practice of non-attachment, but actually it is most merciful. And to really become adept at recognizing what is attachment. Now, not theoretically, now, in this moment. How do I know I'm suffering? Because I see smoke. There must be a fire. The wind traverses the vast sky. Clouds emerge from the mountains. There's no effort. There's no knowing. There's no plan. Feelings of enlightenment, things of the world, are not my concern. And to bring this home, we do have to bring forth great effort. Kezan says, so now you have met a close friend. Do not hope for enlightenment on another day, far in the future. Just look within your own heart, examine carefully. Don't seek from another. If you can do this, hundreds of thousands of teachings and boundless Buddha works all flow from here, covering the heavens and the earth. Just don't seek the way. All you need to do is maintain your true self. Whatever living beings there may be, weak, strong, great, mighty, seen, unseen, born, yet to be born, forsaking none. May all beings be at ease. Let us vow not to deceive each other or despise anyone, any being in any state. Let us free ourselves of anger and ill will and never wish harm upon another. Possessing a boundless heart, may we cherish every living thing and radiate kindness over the entire world, so that finally, and in every step, freed from hatred and ill will, in our standing, walking, seated, and lying down, miraculously aware, no longer meandering in drowsiness, let us sustain this recollection, this mindfulness, this mind, this sublime state of natural awareness. No longer holding to fixed views, your own pure heart, your own clear mind is now finally at rest. You have met a close friend after all of these years. They've always been close, as they are now. You know where they're sitting.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.